Hey, welcome to Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast. I'm Jason.
I'm Kevin.
I'm John.
And I'm Scott.
And we have a great show for you today. Let us know what's on the OR schedule for the day.
Today, Jason, we have Dr. Julie Freischlug, the current Vice Chancellor for Human Health Services and Dean of School of Medicine, UC Davis. But first, I want to let the listeners know that our brand new website is now live online, so check it out at behindtheknife.org. And I think Kevin has a few things to tell you, too.
A few of our dedicated listeners probably noticed that we had a repeat of the random fact of the day. So good catch on that, and we are making the adjustment there. And we're really excited to tell you guys about our new lapel pins out. It's the Behind the Knife lapel pin. It's the scalpel with a drop of blood, and it says the surgery podcast around it. So check it out on Twitter. Check it out on our new website, www.behindtheknife.org.
Yeah, if you follow us on Twitter and tweet us your address, we'll send you a lapel pin.
And to start off, here's our random fact of the day.
And this week's random fact has to do with Christmas and Christmas miracles. Hey, John, do you believe in miracles?
Not usually, Jason.
Well, have you ever heard of the Christmas Truce of 1914?
Yeah, this really was a true Christmas miracle. This is during World War I in 1914 on the Western Front. At the first light of dawn on Christmas Day, some German soldiers emerged from their trenches and approached the Allied lines across no man's land, calling out Merry Christmas in their enemies' native tongues. At first, the Allied soldiers feared it, and they thought it was a trick. But seeing that the Germans were unarmed, they climbed out of their trenches and shook hands with the enemy soldiers. The men exchanged presents of cigarettes and plum puddings and sang carols and songs. There's even a documented case of soldiers from opposing sides playing a good-natured game of soccer. Now, if we could only find the results of that, that would be pretty interesting. The so-called Christmas Truce of 1914 came only 5 months after the outbreak of war in Europe and was one of the last examples of the outdated notion of chivalry between enemies in warfare. It has never been repeated, and future attempts at holiday ceasefires were squashed by officers' threats of disciplinary action, but it served as heartening proof, however brief, that beneath brutal clash of weapons, the soldiers' essential humanity endured.
So this was initiated by the Germans.
That's what it appears. And now that's a heartwarming Christmas miracle to take home and tell your family.
Do you believe in miracles now, John?
Well, it's certainly hard not to, Jason. But let's get to the main event. Here's Dr. Julie Freischlug.
So welcome to another edition of Behind the Knife, everybody. We're absolutely pleased to have Dr. Julie Freischlug, who is the current Vice Chancellor for Human Health Sciences and the Dean of the School of Medicine at UC Davis in Sacramento, California. She previously served as the professor and chair of the surgery department and surgeon-in-chief at Johns Hopkins Medical Institution, and she's done about everything there is to do in surgery, including a governor and secretary of the Board of Governors, a regent and immediate past chair of the Board of Regents of the American College of Surgeons. She's published more than 225 manuscripts, abstracts, books, chapters. She was the editor of JAMA for 10 years and serves on the editorial board for about every major peer-reviewed surgical journal around the world. Dr. Freischlug, thank you so much for joining us on Behind the Knife.
Thanks so much.
So we know a little bit about your academic and your surgical accomplishments. Can you tell us a little bit about you? Tell the listeners, you know, where you're from, how it came to the point where you were into surgery, and take us a little bit of a walk through your life.
Sure. So I was born in Decatur, Illinois, which is a small town south of Chicago, about 3 hours south. And my father was circulation manager of the local newspaper there, and my mother was an elementary school teacher. And he took multiple jobs, so I went to three grade schools and three high schools. We traveled throughout southern Illinois because it was a chain of newspapers. So I lived in Decatur, I lived in Carbondale, Illinois, which is really by Kentucky, and then back up to Urbana. And then he became circulation manager of the Chicago Tribune. So my last part of high school was in the Chicago suburbs. I went to college then back at the University of Illinois, which was down in Urbana, Illinois. And I was going to be a high school biology teacher. That was my thought. But in those days, they actually closed education because they thought there were going to be too many teachers. And I had to make a decision about what to do with my science major. And I sort of went into medicine because to be a nurse, you had to leave school and go up to Chicago to finish it your senior year. And I really didn't want to leave college. I was having a great time and really looked at medicine sort of as the alternative and ended up going to Rush Medical School. I got in their early decision. And again, I thought I was going to be a pediatrician, but then did surgery first as just to get out of the way and found that I actually really loved surgery and was pretty good at it. The people fit my personality, and and also the disease process in the patients did too. I have two brothers. I have one a year ahead of me that I skipped first grade, so we were in the same year my whole life. He's a venture capitalist, and I have a younger brother who's 7 years younger than me that is a special ed high school teacher and also a tennis pro. And we're all in the same family but have very different interests. My older brother's a musician, my younger brother's an artist, and I'm more of a crafter. I'm really not musically oriented or not good enough to paint.
Oh, thank you for that background, ma'am. Now I'd get into more of your professional life. You know, that one of your significant achievements is taking that surgeon in chief job at Johns Hopkins. What would you say your major difficulties and successes were there while your time was there?
Yeah, I think at the time, back in 2002, there really weren't that many leaders in surgery and that were women. And also, I was a specialist. You know, I'm a vascular surgeon. And so I was had looked at quite a few other chair jobs along the way. And part of the reason that this was so important is the dean at that time, Ed Miller, really thought that surgery needed to change. We had just had a very poor year in matching in 2002, where we had some unfilled positions. Part of that, I think, was the entrance of many more women into medical school. Starting about 20 years ago, women started making up more percentage of medical school. In my class, years ago, it was 48%, but we had a very proactive student affairs dean at that time. But with the women making up at least half the class, we weren't attracting women and other underrepresented minorities to surgery, and therefore we didn't fill that year. So it really made us take a deep look into who we were and what we did. And part of it, I think, was the environment of who was there and who we were choosing from, and we weren't choosing from everyone. So at that time, the thought was, since Johns Hopkins really was the number one training program in surgery, that it really needed to be enhanced so that everyone thought they were a candidate. It had been in the past a place that only took from a handful of programs on the East Coast, and we really enhanced it so that we would take candidates from all over the country, so that our residents came from many institutions. And in doing that, we actually got more diversity. And then we also took a lot of international graduates to be our preliminary residents, and that actually added to our diversity as well, too, and really made everyone understand how difficult it can be if you're born in a foreign country and want to be trained as a surgeon in the United States. So the diversity piece was really a focus, just mainly because the best candidates were diverse and we weren't getting them. Similarly, we needed to really focus on developing our specialty groups, because surgery now has so many specialty groups, and so my background as a vascular surgeon really helped us differentiate into teams of endocrine surgeons and liver surgeons and pancreas surgeons, and really focusing on high-end differentiation because of the nature of our healthcare environment. And that really was helpful, too, was to really focus on many different areas of surgery so that we could lead and train in the future with that. We also developed our research programs and really revamped our educational programs so we could comply with the work hour rules. As you probably know, when I first got there the first year, actually all of Hopkins went on probation for work hours. It was mainly because of an infraction in the Department of Medicine. And that actually is one of the best things that happened, because it really made the whole school pay attention to work hours, and therefore surgery had to as well. And it wasn't us that got into trouble, even though we probably could have gotten into trouble at that time with our infractions, but really made us adopt that as a culture. So as I left there, really adhering to the hours, making sure people could develop into any kind of surgeon they want, taking residents from all over the country with all sorts of backgrounds, and really I hired about 110 surgeons over the 11 years that really diversified our faculty as well, with surgeons from all over the country, some international surgeons, more women, as well as those with different interests. So overall, I think we really changed and got us into the 21st century and really made it to continue to be the best training program in the country.
Ma'am, considering the historical significance of that institution, what was it like to kind of sit in the chair that Halstead sat in? And did you have any difficult times during that time? I mean, did you feel like you were well supported, or were there challenges, whether it was because you were a woman, as you mentioned, or just because of the prominence of that particular position?
I think it was a combination. Most everyone knows where they were standing when they heard I got that position, mainly because I wasn't from Hopkins. I was a specialist. I had trained in California. Plus, I was a woman. I think it was the combination of all of that. There was no question I had the credentials. I had the research and the background, the national prominence. But, you know, everybody really wanted that job. And at the time, most people thought it would go to, there was a very good inside candidate. And I had looked at a few other chair jobs, and frankly, they had all gone to inside candidates because there is a loyalty piece and sort of a handing of the gauntlet to the next generation that some people feel they get to choose their successor. And so it was a little surprising I got the job to many people. So when I got there, I was the only woman chair of all the clinical departments. That probably was the most notable thing, is, and that continued for 11 years. There were no other women chairs. So in my bigger piece, which wasn't just the department, as I sat on committees and worked with the dean and other chairs, I was the only woman. And so the diversity piece in the chair group was really probably one of the biggest struggles in the sense that I represented a different opinion. And I have a picture on my wall, actually, from a picture as Ed Miller retired, and everyone's in a black tuxedo but me. I'm in red. And he wrote on that picture, "You are the light of our lives." So part of it, I think, it was carrying the woman leadership piece throughout the institution. And it's my first town hall meeting, women came to that were housekeepers and nurses and desk clerks, because they'd never seen a woman lead anything. And I wasn't only leading the department, I was leading my function was leading the hospital. So I ran the operating rooms, and all the nurses reported to me. So 2,000 people were reporting to me in my role there. So I actually had the other surgeons from the other departments reporting to me for the functionality of the hospital, as well as running my own department of about 150 surgeons. So it was a really big job. So I think part of it was just negotiating and learning the Hopkins way. I actually got a coach, a guy that worked there for years, to help me understand Hopkins culture so you could better negotiate it, so you could see what things were great and what things needed to be changed. And then quickly getting friends and people that you hired and those that were there that were ready to have your back and have you go forward, and really looking at how best we could do things. The biggest adage I always said, if you're really happy now, then we don't have to change anything. But if you're not so happy, we have an opportunity to change. And we really focused first on education, hiring some new faculty, and then really touched more uncomfortable things such as, you know, compensation. I was able to give everybody a raise when I showed up, so that was nice. And so we actually increased compensation some. And with the work hours and the ability for the residents to work in teams, that really attracted residents as well. People did watch me a lot. There was no question they would comment on what I wore and what I did, whether I was in town, out of town, how much I was operating, how much I wasn't. So the first 3 years, you really felt like you were in a fishbowl. There was no question. And so part of it is you just learn to be pretty sort of tough-skinned and always do the right thing and realize not everyone was going to be happy with your decisions, and that was just the way it was.
So, Mel, I had heard that the business plan that you developed was actually studied and, you know, taken up and studied in MBA programs and in healthcare management schools. Is that true? And can you tell us a little bit about how that all came about?
Yeah, well, actually, I wish I could tell you it was proactive, but my administrator, John Hunt, who's still there to this day, and my head of nursing at the time, Lisa Rowan, and the subsequent head of nursing, Deb Baker, we really just developed a program of how to go forward and to really enhance a clinical department. And so we really focused with my ask from this dean's office. Now, this was 2003, as you remember, and this is before the recession. So there were resources. So I got a lot of resources from from the dean's office to hire new faculty, to restructure some of the services, to really enhance our coverage of trauma services and to focus on our specialty services. We also had money to augment research, so we were able to give startup funds to many of our faculty to start research, because our research funding really was only about $1 million a year, and by the time I left, we were ranked in the top 10 for surgical research funding from the NIH. And we started a surgical outcomes group looking at safety and outcomes, and that also we had funding for. And then I did even ask for funding at the time for cultural change, which was money that we could have parties and picnics and learn to know each other and really make it more of a family atmosphere. So it was really just a progression of enhancing our clinical care, our research and education, really focusing on research that actually looked forward rather than backwards. In surgery, many times we just count how many we did and say we did a great job. In this case, we were doing proactive research for safety and outcomes, and really looking at our trauma outcomes and our outcomes from any interventions, as well as looking at prevention, such as prevention of deep venous thrombosis and pulmonary embolism, and working with safety. That's right when also timeouts were mandated in the operating room, and really looking at safety issues in the operating room. We had a great opportunity, since I ran the operating room, to really enforce that. So the whole plan, when you go retrospectively at 10 years, I was able to see what we did. I really wish I could tell you I planned every single minute of what we did. You know, we had some hires that failed. We had some hires that didn't work out quite as we thought. We ended up inheriting a few other hospitals that we incorporated into our network. There's also a Johns Hopkins Bayview Hospital that we redid the leadership there and focused on bariatric surgery and burn surgery there. And then a lot of interactions with the other departments. So with that, one of the people from Harvard came out, Ian came down and really looked at how we incorporated and how do you change culture and make a clinical department be strategic. And frankly, the 10th year I was there, we developed a day for the new dean that came and had all my division chiefs talk about their strategy. And that was sort of the day I realized I didn't need to be chair anymore, that they all knew how to do it. They knew how to strategize. They knew how to do research and education and focus on people's strengths, and that they were well-suited to go forward, and maybe I could look at doing something else.
Ma'am, now I'd like to talk about your transition to California and your current job at UC Davis. Why did you first decide to come out west, and you know, what were your first impressions when you arrived?
Yeah. Well, I trained on the West Coast, so I trained at UCLA after I finished medical school. I had done training here, and I'd worked here a few times. My first job was in UC San Diego, and then I came back to UCLA and ran the VA, and then I went to Milwaukee, but then I came back to UCLA to be a division chief of vascular surgery before I went to Hopkins. So I'd been in California. I never lived in Northern California. And the most amazing thing about UC Davis was their opportunity to change, that it's a medical school that's just barely 50 years old in a couple years. It's one of the five big UC medical centers. There's a new medical school in Riverside that does not own their own hospital. So there's five medical centers in California. So there was an opportunity to come and really enhance UC Davis. Plus, we're trying to form a UC Health, which is incorporating all the UCs together to form a healthcare provider network throughout the state. So I was excited to do that, as well as the deans all get together out here talking about education and research and looking at combined programs with many of the UCs for research that go on. So I thought it was a great way to look at how you could develop a healthcare system for a whole state. I wanted to spend more time with medical students and help them make informed decisions about being great physicians. We're going, as you know, to a more preventative care model and looking at ways to prevent disease, not only operate on it. So working with the medical students was something I wanted to do, as well as how to maintain an academic healthcare center with all the changing reimbursement models. So I looked at a few other dean's positions as well. This one was great because my chancellor, she's a woman, and my CEO is a woman as well, and there's a lot of diversity at UC Davis, so it actually wasn't unusual for a woman to take the dean's position here. I actually replaced a woman. The previous dean was a woman, Claire Pomeroy, who went to the Lasker Foundation as the president. So out here is sort of a little different than the Hopkins picture as far as diversity and ability to make a difference in a place that really does a lot of great clinical care. It's the only trauma center in Northern California. We serve all of Northern California, which is about 7 million people in a land mass about the size of Pennsylvania. So we use a lot of telehealth. We have a lot of underrepresented patients and underserved patients in this area. It's about 40% Hispanic, and therefore an opportunity to serve the needs of a whole group of patients that probably are a little neglected by the system, and figure out ways to get them to get access as well as good intervention.
Okay, well, now it's time in the podcast where we go into our dissection of the day. This is a segment where we delve more in depth about a particular topic. And with you, we wanted to discuss your work in the field of resiliency. So I was wondering if we could just start off and you know, talk to us about what the concept of resiliency really means both to you as well as to trainees.
Sure. Well, when people ask me all the time, you know, how did you succeed? I had a medical student actually come in with a piece of paper and a pencil and says, give me the five things I need to do so I can be a dean someday. You know, and I really wish it was that easy, you know, because as you go through life, you're not going to get everything you want. I looked at many chairs positions before I got the Hopkins position. I looked at quite a few dean's jobs before I got this one, because it's all a matter of fit and timing. So you won't get everything you want, and sometimes you'll be very disappointed in people's behavior or activity, and it won't be fair all the time. I found out years later, 20 years after I went through the match for surgery, I had ranked San Francisco first and then San Diego and Los Angeles, and I ended up getting Los Angeles. Actually, they had dropped my slip on the floor and they couldn't find it, so I was just relieved to match anywhere when I got it. But 20 years later, I was sitting with a fella who was the fellow in vascular surgery at UCSF when I was a fourth-year student doing a sub-internship. And he said, you know, I really didn't know how to tell you this, but, you know, back 20 years ago, when we were forming our rank list at UCSF the year you applied, the chair of surgery took out all the women's names. There were three of us. And he said, I'm not ranking any of these women. And it really devastated me, because for 20 years, I actually thought I wasn't good enough to get into UCSF, that I wasn't qualified, and that it was great I got at UCLA. But, oh, my goodness, you know, I guess they didn't think highly enough of me through my sub-internship. And instead, I found out I was really never given a chance to go to UCSF. And I'm probably not the only person that had been pulled out of a rank list around that time. Now, of course, we don't do those things, but it really gave me pause to realize there probably were many opportunities that I was not given, that I didn't even know. However, I just kept going. So I think resilience by definition is, you know, being able to bounce back from things that you don't get or things that happen. But I really am defining it more. I just gave a talk at the American College of Surgeons, Olga Jonasson talk, which she was the first woman chair at Ohio State, and it's named for her, is that resilience, I think, is just bouncing up, so that you're able to bounce up despite things happening, because there's always going to be someone who doesn't appreciate you, whether it's the way you look or your gender or where you trained or whatever, and they're not going to give you an opportunity. And what you need to realize is that that's actually okay, that you need to thank all those people that didn't give you the chances, because you ended up somewhere else that really will give you a good opportunity as well, and that there will be people that appreciate you. Now, where do you get that? You know, you have to make sure you have good self-confidence. You have to make sure you're really good at what you do. So I tell my students all the time that they have to be excellent. You know, you have to train well, you have to do well on your exams, you have to be a really good surgeon or a really good pediatrician, you have to make sure that you are a great teacher, that you lead with your science and do your research. I've told young people at meetings, you know, get up and ask questions so they know who you are, and then walk up to a famous person every day and at a meeting and introduce yourself so people know who you are and that you're going to make a difference. And so I think for me, I wanted to be a really good surgeon. That's how I went through this. And so I trained well. I became a really good surgeon. I wanted to teach well. So I did that because I always wanted to be a teacher. I did my research, whether it was basic science or translational or outcomes research. I presented it and made sure people knew I became experts in things. And then I also was very inclusive. I've always included lots of residents and students and others, and I've never, ever resented being more generous, but have really been a little bit sad if I was not as inclusive. And so I think being inclusive, being generous, being really good, and then realizing that your potential and what you can do with leadership can help others. So where I got that, I don't know whether it's from my background. You know, my one grandfather was a coal miner and my other one made boilers for the railroad. You know, I come from a very blue-collar background, whether it's because I was raised with two brothers, so, you know, you can't really whine much around a home like that, or whether it was my mother that basically said, get a good education and you can do whatever you want. I also have a very good sense of right from wrong. You know, I never do things that aren't right. I would never take advantage of people or lie or not be truthful. And so I think really taking that upper hand of always doing the right thing and then always realizing that if it doesn't go your way, that that might be the best day. It's just that you don't realize it that day, but it will end up bouncing you up to the place you need to be.
Ma'am, understanding that part of this has to come from within, from a leadership point of view, how can leaders instill this in those around them, whether you're in surgery or medicine or in any occupation?
Well, I think you need to give people chances. I actually gave a talk a couple years ago when I was president of the Society for Vascular Surgery on strategy and chances. You know, I think there always has to be a strategy. You always need to think about where your team is going and what they're doing, whether your team is 3 people or 30 people or 300 or 3,000. You need to always make sure everybody knows where everything's headed so that people can join in and be part of the team. And I think that's what's so important, is to be inclusive with that. And then give people chances. I mean, you never know if someone can do something unless you let them try. So allowing people to have leadership positions early that may require taking some of your senior people and moving them out of the way, whether you give them another position or you just move them away, because many people can't give up their leadership positions. They think the minute they're no longer there, people will forget them or not listen to them. And so making sure you allow young people to lead early, making sure they go to leadership courses and so they understand how to be a good leader so that they are a leader that is inclusive and generous. I think that's the newest way to be a leader, and people need to understand that's the style. And then if they're not doing a good job, really give them great feedback. I think that's the other thing. I'm really good at looking at someone and saying, I know you think you're doing a great job, but are you? I just talked to someone last week asking if they thought they were the heir apparent in their area for the new leader. And of course, he said yes. Well, no one sees him in that light. So we had a conversation saying, you need now to go meet with someone to figure this out because no one sees you like this, even though you do. And he was very sad. You know, I followed him up with the next day, but no one had told him. Instead, they just talked about him not being able to be a leader. So I think part of this is being honest with people, getting people in the right spot. Everyone's got a spot where they can be amazing. It sometimes takes a little bit more effort with some people to get them to that spot. And then as long as people are truthful and have some insight, I think you can work with them. And then the minute you find people who are not truthful and don't have insight, to really remove them. They don't get the privileges of someone who has insight and truthfulness. They can't teach. You shouldn't let them deal with residents. You certainly shouldn't let them teach medical students. They probably shouldn't be dealing with patients, because those people really don't have the best interest of the patient or the resident or the student at heart. And they should go find something else they can do, maybe research or private practice or something, but they really shouldn't be involved and teaching our new generation, because then those bad qualities or those bad attributes will just be perpetuated.
Ma'am, from a dean perspective, can you construct a curriculum around this concept, and it should just be a part of surgical training for all residents?
Yeah, that's a great question. So this year, the first year, is I gave them a talk on leadership and professionalism the first week they were here. And we are developing more professional lectures in their doctoring course. We have a great doctoring course here where people talk about what it's like to be a professional. Some of our senior people really can fill that role. They can talk about how to treat patients and others to do that. Really giving people books to read and things to talk about. I give all my residents and students, tell them to read the book Drive by Daniel Pink, which actually talks about, you know, what would you like your sentence to be after if someone meets you? Would you like them to say you're easy to work with and smart and great, or would you like them to say you're really sort of not the nicest person and they really don't want to speak with you again? You know, really looking at situational awareness and having some emotional intelligence and giving people books to read and think about that. And I think having that as part of the discussion, and then the most important thing, I think, as you teach and train people is to make sure they understand that if they do behave in a different way, that you do give them feedback and confront them on behaviors or comments that are inappropriate so they can reset themselves. The worst thing is to ignore it and think it's going to get better on its own. And I think for all of us, you know, surgeons especially, we've had reputations in the past where maybe we were difficult to work with and demanding, and sometimes that's important when you're in the middle of an emergency operation, but it doesn't work at all when you're in a boardroom or you're trying to work in teams. So really giving that feedback so people understand how they're viewed, and then also promoting and giving opportunities to those that are excellent at those things so that those are the ones that go forward and people can see who gets opportunities and try to be more like that person than others that perhaps don't do all the right things at all the times.
That's going to lead us to our segment on tips and tricks. This is where we ask our experts to talk about those helpful hints to get us out of those sticky situations. And Dr. Fleischlag, since one of the things you're obviously very well known for is thoracic outlet syndrome, one of the things we wanted to talk to you about is this. And in particular, that is confusing anatomy. We have a lot of medical students and residents that listen to us from around the world. And what is your advice to them in terms of delineating anatomy, identifying the nerves, what planes you can get into, and on the, you know, where, how do you avoid the thoracic duct?
Great. So I learned how to do thoracic outlet surgery from Herb Mackletter when I was a fellow at UCLA. And he really was one of the first people to champion the transaxillary approach. And so every Tuesday, he would have three or four patients we would operate on. And the best thing that he taught me not only about doing the operation is he was a great philosopher. He had a great philosophy of life. He had been in the Peace Corps. He had done many interesting things. And he also investigated the syndrome, especially neurogenic thoracic outlet syndrome, and had examined the scalene muscle to show that it had changed fiber type, and really taught me how to best choose the patient as well as do the operation. So over the years, I did a little bit of thoracic outlet surgery when I was at Milwaukee and at San Diego. Then when I came back to UCLA, there were about three of us that did it. We had a big center there. And then when I went to Hopkins, they really didn't have a center and nobody was doing it. And in order to sort of sketch out something that was just mine that would not impede upon the other vascular surgeon, especially the other division chief of vascular, we started a program there, which over when we finished, when I left, I bet we were the biggest program in the country. We were doing probably 150 patients a year surgically and probably seeing three times that much in the office. And we started a center here. I have a young partner, Misty Humphreys, here, and we see about 10 new patients a week, and we're operating on probably 6 to 10 patients a month. So part of it is you need to set up a whole program thoracic outlet because you'll see many people that you don't operate on, and that program has to include physical therapists and pain management people, as well as ability to differentiate people that should and should not have the operation. We published a lot on that, showing that older patients don't do so well with the operation, older being over the age of 40, patients with long-term pain and discomfort and pain in other areas, those that smoke, those on lots of narcotics, they really don't do well with the operation. And so we really have curtailed offering operative intervention to those patients. In the venous patients, we tend to operate on all of them when they clot off their vein. And it does appear that the patency rate of the vein is almost 95% if you do an operation. And we do a venogram after the procedure, which was a new technique for everyone, so that we know that the vein intrinsically is good too. So not only do we take the rib out, but we think there's some chronic scarring of the vein that needs to be addressed. So we'll blow up a balloon in that area 2 weeks after surgery. And then arterial thoracic outlet is very rare. But in my experience, I have found that you really should use autologous vein. All the patients that I've put PTFE grafts in, they eventually go down because there's too much range of motion in that shoulder. So I really think that autologous vein in that area, because of the motion, because of the decreased bed distally due to embolization, that's the best thing. Now, for the operation itself, you really need to do a lot to be good because there's a lot of anomalies in that area of muscles and nerves. And so I use the transaxillary approach. We make sure we use a lot of lighting in that area. We have a special retractor that Dr. Mackletter designed that now you can buy commercially. So we use a special retractor that opens up that spot so you can identify all the structures. And that's the key tip, is you have to identify the vein initially and then look for the scalene anticus, the artery, and the nerve so that you don't injure any of those structures. And I've never injured any of the brachial plexus. We've had a couple small injuries to veins and arteries, one requiring reoperation in 25 years, but you have to see everything. And you can teach it because you can look in that area, you can take your time and elevate the rib, cut the muscle, and make sure everyone sees what's going on. And I do draw a picture during the procedure, and all my fellows do the same thing, so you can identify all the structures. You take a break every 15, 20 minutes to relax the arm so it doesn't get a stretch on the brachial plexus. And really, you need to also resect the entire rib. So you have to go anteriorly and remove the rib all the way to the manubrium. And you have to cut the rib behind the nerve. So that may actually take two or three cuts to get the rib away from the nerve. So when the arm goes down, that nerve doesn't touch that rib at all, so they won't get recurrent symptoms. So I think choosing the right patient, making sure you identify all the structures, resecting the entire rib, and in the venous, making sure you do a post-op venogram to make sure the vein is perfect, and arterial, if all possible, using autologous tissue such as saphenous vein and not prosthetic in that area, are all the things that we've learned. We've published a lot on this, looking at quality of life and the fact that they're sustained with their relief of symptoms over years. So I think we really do understand this procedure really well. And to be able to teach it like I'm teaching it to my younger partner is really key so that you have good outcomes long term.
Well, that was great. That was a fantastic overview. Thank you. But so that leads us into our last segment of the show, and this is what we call the final five. These are just five quick and easy questions. They're meant to be fun and, you know, lighthearted. So question number one, do you listen to music in the operating room? And if so, what will we find on your iPod?
You know, I've been asked that question a couple times. When I was in Milwaukee, I answered a radio station. At that time, it was Bonnie Raitt. We did an article when we were at in Baltimore at Hopkins, and then at that time it was Adele. And there's a picture of me showing her CD to do that. Now I listen to whatever the fellows have because I want to learn new music. So now whatever is new and out there, I'm listening to in the operating room. My fellows at Hopkins the last couple of years liked old stuff, but now I'm listening to the new things. So I'm not even sure I can tell you what they are, but I'm game. I'll listen to whatever they have. They just have to make sure it's not too loud.
Okay.
Our second question, ma'am, is do you have any hobbies, talents, or interests when you're not in the operating room?
Yeah, I love to swim, so I always have a swimming pool in my backyard, so I was a lifeguard. So here, what's great in Northern California, I can swim, you know, about 8 months a year. We have a solar-heated pool, so I swim. My husband and I walk. I still do a little bit of running. I am a crafter, so I make all sorts of things. I make many gifts for holiday. I make baby clothes now for my granddaughter. I love to sew, and I'm right now making a great big Christmas tree skirt out of felt for one of my kids. And I also love to read, so I'm reading fiction all the time. I read leadership books. I probably read maybe about 150 books a year. I just really love reading, and so that's one of my other escapes.
Excellent. Well, number three, is there a particular, you know, trip or vacation that stands out in your mind as one of your favorites or as particularly memorable?
Yeah. Well, my son, I have a 20-year-old son who's a junior at University of Maryland, and I have two stepkids that actually live in L.A. and Berkeley, and they're both married. They're 34 and 36, and one has a baby. I have a granddaughter who's 14 months old. And when I look back, we used to take quite a few vacations with them because you're so busy at work. So with the older ones, we did a lot more amusement parks and more classic vacations. But with my son, we've traveled quite a bit through, you know, Mexico and Europe. But we really loved going to Hilton Head. And we just went back this year, mainly because it's so peaceful. It was a place we always went back to. We liked eating at some of the same places. We like to swim. My husband likes to golf. And we would sort of wake up every day and just be peacefully entertained. And we actually just purchased a condo there so that we can go back there many more times because my son's still on the East Coast. So that was nice because we went back multiple times and we could remember when we were there. And my son will tell you some of his most memorable times were the vacations we took every year. So that he actually had my undivided attention, so I wasn't busily working. So Hilton Head, just because it reminds me of his entire childhood.
Perfect. Question number four, what would you be doing if you were not in medicine?
I used to say I would want to be a professional ice skater because I always loved to ice skate, and I thought it was so beautiful. And I did take ice skating in college. And I got that I could do a little bit of a spin and a jump, but not so much. So as I've gotten older, I'm not sure being a professional ice skater would be capable of. So I would probably own a bed and breakfast. My husband cooks great breakfast, and I love decorating and having those old homes, and I love meeting people. So I think we would own a bed and breakfast, probably either in Napa, since we're close here, or maybe back in Hilton Head.
Excellent. All right. Well, number five, if you could go back in time and meet yourself on your first day of your surgical internship, what one piece of advice would you give yourself?
Oh, that's great. I actually, we just had our 35th reunion for my medical school, and I found a picture in a box of me as an intern. And I, you know, old picture, like an actual picture. Remember those? And I actually sat there and thought of myself, and the picture was sort of a crazy picture with another intern laughing. And I guess I would say, don't take yourself so seriously. I tell that to young faculty, too. You work so hard, and it's tough. You know, people aren't always going to have the best results from surgery. Some people are going to die. It's just really a tough, tough thing. And to maintain your sense of humor and not take yourself so seriously so that you think everything has to be perfect, because even more senior surgeons and those with more experience will have things happen to them that they didn't want to. Because we were in-house every other night when I was an intern. Maybe that's where I got my resilience, because physically you just had to keep going. But really to stay happy and not take yourself as seriously, that you will get through it and you will become a good surgeon. And it just takes time to do that. And everyone has times where it isn't going as well as you would like.
You know, man, that's a very common answer we hear from this, people who've been in surgery for a lot of time. So it's definitely something to take away. Well, Dr. Freshlich, thank you for joining us on Behind the Knife. You gave us a great rundown of your background, your thoughts on resiliency, and then obviously those great tips on dealing with thoracic outlet syndrome. You know, it's always great hearing from the leaders in the surgical field. And, you know, one day we hope to have you back.
Well, thanks so much. It was fun to talk to you. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Just a reminder, we can be found at Twitter at Behind the Knife, on Facebook at Behind the Knife, and on our website at www.behindtheknife.org. We really want this to be an interactive experience, so give us your random fact of the day, your tips and tricks, or topics you want to hear. And we're also going to tweet out who we're interviewing that day, and you guys can send in your questions, and we'll read them live on the show. This podcast can be found on iTunes and any other podcast provider.
All right, looks like count's correct, sash is closed, and the dressings are on.
Until next time, thank you for joining us on Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast. Dominate the day.